Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, in for Brian Lehrer, and we're 17 months into the civil war in Syria. Today, the prime minister either defected or was fired, depending on who you ask, becoming the latest high-level official to flee the country. And yesterday, 48 Iranians were kidnapped in Damascus. They were either religious pilgrims or members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, depending again on who you ask. And now, as the fighting intensifies in both Aleppo and Damascus, the international community seems paralyzed. Joining us now is Deb Amos, who covers the Middle East for NPR. Welcome back to WNYC, Deb.
Thank you, Brooke.
So, you got 29 Syrian army generals who have defected along with many other government officials today. Prime Minister Riyad Farid Hijab left for Jordan. Syria's official media reported that he was fired by President Assad. The opposition said he defected. Which is it?
It appears that he did defect. Jordanian officials have confirmed that he did cross the border. There was a spokesperson for him on Al Jazeera, the Arabic satellite channel that is what everybody is watching. Apparently, he left with 10 families. He's got 8 brothers. And this is the way these defections work. You don't leave alone. You have to be sure that your families are out. Mm-hmm. We've seen this again and again. And apparently this huge crowd crossed the border into Jordan.
If this was a defection, is it any different from any of the other defections?
It is quite a bit different. For one thing, this man has only had his job for 2 months, and what his spokesman is saying is that he planned all along. It took him more than 2 months to plan for him to get out of the country, and the reason for that is what we've seen over the last 24 hours. They had to get 10 families out. For a prime minister to quit, to say what he said, which is this is a murderous regime, so close to the center of power, a man who was considered a loyalist, part of the Ba'ath Party, that's the structure of power in the country, for him to leave is a very big deal.
It doesn't sound like he was vetted very well for the job.
I think it's very difficult now for Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, to know who is a loyalist and who is not anymore. I should also point out that the prime minister is a Sunni Muslim, so there is a sectarian tinge to what has just happened. The elite in the country are Alawites. That is the clan that the president belongs to. And it may be that Sunni Muslims can no longer serve in this government, certainly not with any trust from the elite.
So let's talk about those 48 Iranians. The official Syrian media and the Iranian government say they were religious pilgrims, including women and children, on their way to a Shiite shrine in the suburbs of Damascus. Some rebel leaders insist that they were, quote, Iranian thugs from the Revolutionary Guard on a reconnaissance mission. Meanwhile, the Free Syrian Army, which is one of several umbrella rebel groups, denies any knowledge of the operation. What's going on here?
Well, the Free Syrian Army is an army only in name. It is loosely organized, and that is even a bit of a stretch to talk about what the Free Syrian Army is. It is quite possible that a group that is in that neighborhood decided that they were going to pick up these Iranian pilgrims. It is a neighborhood that is filled with Iranians. There's a very, very historical and important Shiite shrine in that neighborhood. There's a lot of Iraqi Shiites that are also living in that neighborhood. But would
pilgrims walk into the middle of a civil war?
Well, that neighborhood has been a bit of a problem, and there has been shooting in that neighborhood. Yet, we have also seen a few months ago, there was a bus full of Shiite pilgrims who drove through one of the most contentious parts of the country. They were from Lebanon. And I often wonder if they are not reading the news. And it may, in fact, be that they're watching too much Syrian television, and they didn't see it coming.
So we don't know which of these stories is correct, but you're saying pilgrims. So on the basis of past experience, you think they might well be.
It's possible. It is possible. And I don't think that we're going to know. What we do know is that the Iranian government is working very hard to get them out and has called on the Turkish government, the government of Qatar, anybody who the Iranians think have some connection to the Free Syrian Army to try to get them out. This is a classic kidnapping. And so people are behaving as they do in all kidnappings until we know more. I think that you have to assume that either they are pilgrims or they are part of the Revolutionary Guard. Take your pick, Brooke. In this story, it is always hard to tell.
And Iran is probably the closest ally of the Alawite government of Syria.
Indeed. And the government of Iran pays for many, many pilgrims to come to Syria because of the shrines there. So it's not a big surprise. In fact, I remember during the last Iranian election, there are so many Iranians that come to Syria that there were voting booths. There were two of them, one in the very neighborhood that we're talking about and one at the Iranian Cultural Center. So it's no surprise that there are many, many Iranian pilgrims in Syria. It's also no surprise that Iranian Republican Guards are there as well.
Why can't any of this be verified? Since we last spoke, foreign journalists have been able to get into Syria, at least in Aleppo. Why is everything still a big question mark?
I think in part because there are so many attempts to muddy the water. Let me give you an example of just last week. The Reuters news site, Thomson Reuters, was hacked twice, not once, but twice. And the stories that began to appear on Twitter and on websites and on Google News said that the Free Syrian Army had withdrawn from Aleppo, one of the hottest battles right now that's going on in Syria, in a northern financial hub of the country. I had people send me emails saying, it's over. It's over. The Free Syrian Army has lost. And I looked around to see what news they were talking about. And it turned out that Reuters had been hacked twice. And fake stories were posted on the web. So you can see why there is so much confusion about information. I think that we can say that the prime minister defected because we have that now from Jordanian officials. That seems pretty hard information. To know the identity of the Iranians who have been picked up in Sena Zeynep neighborhood in Damascus, that is much harder.
So the UN, I mentioned in the intro the seeming paralysis of the international community. On Friday, a huge majority of the UN General Assembly backed a resolution blaming the Syrian government for the conflict and demanding that Kofi Annan's peace plan, as it were, be carried out. We know that the Security Council can't act because Russia and China back the Syrian government's right to remain in power. So is this all a bunch of spitting in the wind?
I think that one of the things that you talked about in your intro, that this is a civil war, you have to add that this is also a regional war. The dimensions of the conflict in Syria have grown to a regional proportion. So you have a conflict between the United States, Russia, and China over Syrian policy. You have a conflict between Saudi Arabia, the Sunni powerhouse in the region, against Iran, the Shiite powerhouse in the region. All of these things are being played out in Syria at the same time, which has brought a paralysis in the international community to have some consistent policy to turn to diplomacy rather than force to end this conflict. You know, I was in southern Turkey about a month ago, and even the top officers of the Free Syrian Army, those officers who have defected and are in southern Turkey, will tell you that they can't win this militarily, that it has to be a diplomatic solution. It's just that neither side is yet willing to talk.
But you think they will? Because it seemed like it had all just become about the guns, and a lot of these videos, as we have discussed in the past, have been directed towards individual fundraisers to help support this revolution. So do they really think that there's any chance that they'll be able, that the international community will be able to act?
Well, we've had a new element added to videos for fundraising purposes, and that is, for the first time now, Americans if they wish to, can donate money to support the Free Syrian Army. For the first time ever, a lobbying group called the Syrian Support Group opened an office in Washington, and the president's office has issued a finding that they are licensed to fundraise on behalf of the rebels. They can't directly buy weapons. However, that's not how it works. It works with money. Money goes to bank accounts in Turkey, and then those people who have access to those funds pay arms dealers, smugglers in Turkey to move the weapons across the border. We have privatized this revolution even further. And so it's hard to see how talks are coming soon. There is no consensus in the international community at the moment in how to bring this violence to an end.
So a classic Middle Eastern catch-22. They need the international community to get involved in order to resolve this. The international community is becoming balkanized further and further and therefore cannot become involved. So endless conflict?
I think that we will see such conflict for a while to come. There are opposition groups who have called for some sort of talks. There was a meeting in Rome from opposition groups who asked for exactly that, who are saying quite loudly, you cannot win this on the battlefield. It is impossible for a rebel force to beat an army. However, what we see now is a variety of transitional plans, and even those are not united. The Free Syrian Army rebel groups have put out a transitional plan of their own. There is a part of the opposition that has announced themselves as the government in exile. There is a brigadier general who defected, Manaf Talas, a childhood friend of President Bashar al-Assad, who has put himself forward as a transitional figure. So you see, this is three-dimensional chess, and it's hard to imagine how to corral all of these disparate ideas to bring together some sort of diplomatic idea, and now there is not anyone in charge of the UN procedure. Kofi Annan has quit. There are countries in the Gulf who say that they will not approve of anybody taking over his job, that diplomacy is over.
If anybody has questions for Deb Amos, she is the best person to ask questions. Call 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Deb, you're always the one I go to when I have questions. There are several rebel factions. Some of them want foreign intervention. Others don't. Some just want to be supplied with weapons. Some want to be left alone. What, I know I keep asking this question, but it's because it keeps dominating the news. Is there any, do you foresee any kind of role for the international community? Unless it's Russia. Does Russia offer the only hope?
In some ways, and for some time now, there had been some hope that the Russians would take a role. The whole point of them being so prominent in the way that Syria was playing out, being so close to Bashar, was the hope that Russia could guide this transition. They had the most at stake, it was thought. They are a longtime ally of Damascus. They have a naval base there. And the idea was that perhaps the Russians could ease Bashar out in some political transition. The stumbling block always was this. Even Russia can't force someone to leave office if they don't want to. And till now, it appears that President Bashar al-Assad has no intention of leaving. He gave a statement a few days ago exhorting his army to bring what he calls the terrorists to bay in Aleppo, probably the most important city in the country. It is the financial hub. It's the largest city in Syria in the north. And the Russian position has pretty much stayed the same. They continue to insist that it is the Syrians that will have to decide. The problem is the Syrians are hopelessly divided. And as time goes on, this becomes a much more sectarian conflict. And it seems unlikely that the Syrians can decide.
Let's talk David in Flushing. Can you come in? Are you there? David? Dave?
Wish anything more than a civil war between majority Sunnis and minority Shiites who had been ruling the Sunnis. Is there anything more to it than that?
Okay. So it's not just a two-pronged war, right, Deb? There's also, there's a Syrian Christian community. There are, international players like Iran. But does this really boil down to a Sunni-Shiite conflict in the end?
Let's remember that it didn't start that way. This was yet again another revolt during what we thought of as the Arab Spring that's turned into a winter and another spring, and it seems to have no season. This was, as it was in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, a spontaneous revolt, mostly young people who said, we have no future under these systems of dictatorships in the Middle East. And so our idea is to go to the streets to demonstrate our displeasure, to break the wall of fear. And in those early days, those demonstrations were participated widely by Sunnis, Christians, even Alawites were part of that non-violent movement. As time has gone on, it has devolved into a sectarian conflict, a zero-sum game between communities who those who support the president feel like they have no mm-hmm. future in a Syria that is dominated by Sunni Muslims. And the voices of the Christians and the Alawites in the revolution are much fainter than they were in the early days. And you now have an international dimension that makes it much more complex. It didn't start that way, but it has evolved into, I fear, a conflict that has a very dangerous sectarian element to it.
There's another county we haven't heard from too much, but we may now. There was an attack on a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria late last week. 20 people were killed. The Palestinians have been pretty much neutral up until now. The rebels blame the Syrian army for what happened. The army blames the rebels. And analysts say that the Palestinians have already begun to drift away from Assad's government. Is movement in that group significant? Could it have an impact?
It is very significant. It is not quite right to call it a Palestinian refugee camp. I have been to the Yarmouk neighborhood, and it is a neighborhood. It has there are no tents there. Mm-hmm. There are apartment blocks. It's a poor neighborhood, but it is the kind of neighborhood that's been there for years. This is, two, three generations of Palestinians who actually felt quite Syrian and were part of the fabric of that society.
So it's a community, not a camp.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The beginning of the unraveling of the relationship between the Syrian government and the Palestinians came actually quite early in the revolt when the government put buses out for Palestinians to go down to the Golan Heights. This is a place that's in contention with Syria and Israel for 30 years. And they tried to cross the border into Israel, and some of them were shot and killed. And the elders in the Palestinian community felt betrayed by the regime. The regime had always portrayed itself as, the head of the resistance against Israel in the region. And in fact, President Bashar al-Assad has often said that that is the reason that he is the target of an international conspiracy because of his strong resistance against Israel in favor of the Palestinians. What has happened in the past couple of weeks undermines that identity for the Syrian government. To have the Palestinians side with the revolt, and we have already seen that Hamas, which is one of the Islamist parts of the Palestinian political landscape, leave Damascus, move out of Damascus, was a big sign that the Palestinians were actually taking a position. What has happened in the Yarmouk neighborhood is a much stronger signal. Younger Palestinians have already been joining the revolt. Older Palestinians feel that they are guests in Syria and they don't want to rock the boat. Now, a few weeks ago, there was a sniper shooting of a Palestinian, a big funeral, And the government very publicly said to the Palestinian community, remember, you are guests, which means we can kick you out of here. And so you see this unraveling of that relationship.
We've had some comments on the comment page asking about what this means for Israel. Some Israeli officials have said, oh, we've never been friends with Syria, but better to stick with the devil you know. Or is it just that as the Palestinians drift away, they drift towards?
I think that the position of Israel is the same as the position of Jordan. An unstable Syria is bad news for the region. Israel has the same concerns as Iraq does, as Jordan does, as Turkey does. This conflict, it can spill across all of these borders. And that is why it is important for the international community to have some sort of policy, but it simply doesn't look like they are capable of doing so.
Deb, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
NPR Middle East correspondent Deborah Amos.